Greetings, I'm Fred Zaspel. Welcome to another author interview here at Books at a Glance. We're talking again, Dr. Steve Wellum. We're working our way through his first volume of Systematic Theology, and we are in chapter 18 still, working through some of these, as we were just saying, simple ideas of God's attributes, complex and profound as they are. Steve, welcome back. Let's pick it up with the attribute of God's eternality. Explain what is meant by the eternality of God. How is it different from his everlastingness? What's going on with all of that?
Yeah, I mean these attributes are glorious, and but they stump us, right? I mean, we are just space time finite creatures. So eternality at its heart, right, is that God has always existed, right? And there's never a time where he's not existed. And of course, out of that, we've already talked about aseity, right? God has life from himself, existence from himself. We as creatures come to exist, right? And even if we talk about God sustaining us forever, which he will, right? So we'll live forever, right? But it's not eternality, right? So God always exists. He has existence from himself. He will not exist, right? He is the constant one, the faithful one. And then it's picking up ultimately eternality, his relation to time. So
yeah, I was going to ask you about that next.
Yeah. Good. So when we think of, you know, created things, and I think it's best to think of created things as sort of space time. Space and time is bound up with creation, but there was before creation, right? So we don't have space and time without the created order, without God creating the heavens and the earth. So that what's, you know, Francis Schaeffer, that I remember a message of his, what was before the beginning, right? So what was before Genesis 1:1? Well, the eternal God, the God who's always existed, and the God who is not in time, right? Time doesn't apply to him. It's just so hard to grasp as space-time creatures because space and time are bound up with creation. So eternality is picking that up. And a lot of people will then say, well, that's timelessness. And of course, that's a way of getting around your mind around that. And of course, there's some truth in that, but we have to be careful that timelessness, especially when you create the world, he's sort of out of time and the world's in time. And eternality, I think historically, is a bit richer than just simply saying timeless, which is true, but there's no succession of moments. He has his life within himself, right? And he fullness of life. Before there's ever a space-time universe, he always exists. In light of that creation of a space-time universe, he now relates to that, but he's not in space. He's not in time, yet he is fully present everywhere. And that, of course, speaks of presence, but also his constant in terms of eternality. So everlastingness is a idea that people have had. And of course, they're trying to wrestle with God is eternal. There is no universe. He makes a world. And then how does he relate to that world? These are always the difficult issues that one has to be careful, because you have to preserve the creator-creature distinction. You don't want to move towards panentheism, where the world now becomes absorbed in God, or God is now in the world. I mean, there's always has to be that transcendence, that distinction between creator and the creation. But everlastingness sort of is the idea that in creating the world, he then sort of is now in time. He is in space. So he is now everlasting, that he has duration throughout time. And I understand what they're trying to do. The problem with that is it now places sort of God in the creation, sort of, if careful, doesn't have some kind of limitation or some kind of change in him, that his now being is now different than what it was prior to that creation. And these are all the areas that you're trying to carefully navigate. So eternality, I think, Bavinck, I think, or Burkhoff says this, perfection of God, whereby he is elevated above all temporal limits, all succession of moments, possesses the whole of his existence in one indivisible present, yet in creation of the world, he's also still eternal, yet he is with us, and he's not limited, and he's time and space don't limit him. And so that's enough to boggle our imagination, but he remains the eternal God.
Well, I think this needs a little bit more explanation for some people because this is really, well, it's confusing for all of us because it's above us. We get that it's that God is above time. We get that time is in relation to us, not God. But when you say, like you just quoted, that God possesses the whole of his existence in one indivisible presence, well, then, and then you also mentioned that he's above the succession of moments, but certainly God knows the difference between before creation and after, and in particular, God the Son knows the difference before incarnation and after. How do we put all that together?
Well, I mean, carefully, don't we? I mean, and our my little finite mind has to sort of put these together. And you're looking at you look at sort of the various options that are given. And I think what you're trying to preserve is to make sure that we're holding everything together without then drawing conclusions that lead to further problems and say of, okay, now God is really changing now, and God is gaining. Sort of in terms of his relationship to the world, he's becoming different, or you don't want to say better or worse, but there's some kind of
No.
change, of course, which affects then the notion of him being acted upon and now a kind of dependency to the world. All those things you have to be careful of. So yeah, with eternality, I mean, I think the best of the theologians have spoken of it is that he is his whole existence is in himself and his life is in himself. And of course, that of course is before there's ever a creation. There's the fullness of life. There's no adding to God. There's the fullness of relation. There's the triune relations that are there in creating the world. The world obviously is space-time. It's changing. He relates to that world, but it's not. He's not dependent upon that world. He's not be conditioned by that world. Yet he has also, in his relation to that world, his divine plan, his divine decree. He knows exactly, I mean, in that decree, there's temporal succession in the sense that it's in the outworking of it, there's creation and
Right.
history and so on. And all of God as the eternal one relates to that world. So I sort of think you have to be careful of this. I mean, it's almost like different dimensions in some sense. So God's being is eternal, yet he relates to the world without change in him, and particularly in terms of his internal self. He relates to the world, and it's tied to his divine plan, decree. The Son of God, I think we have to clearly say that the Son of God, the person of the Son, assumes a human nature, and that human nature is created, right? That it's part of creation. It's he in that humanity continue, I mean, is growing in wisdom, stature. He is changed. He's experiencing space. He's experiencing time. So you have to say that in that humanity, and at the same time, you have to say that he is true deity. That he in, you know, this is the extra outside of that human experience. There is a divine life that is full and doesn't change. The persons of the Godhead do not change. There's relations that are there. Yet his in his humanity, there is a real creaturely existence. We have to be careful that we don't take, and this is where we're you know, we swim in the deep end, but we have to be careful that we don't take what's true of the Son in his humanity and
Right.
bring that back into the internal life of God. That seems to be what a person like, say, a Karl Barth is doing, and then people that move in that direction. It seemed to be also some of the discussion that went on at Westminster in Philadelphia with Scott Oliphant. I mean, I'm not sure where he's at on these issues now, but he would speak about God taking on covenantal properties, such as ignorance and location, and that. And his appeal was always to the humanity of Christ. And it seemed to me that one of his main problems was taking what was true of the Son in his humanity and bringing that back into God. And ironically, it's a kind of Barthian problem because Karl Barth always wanted to see, in terms of the divine decree, everything in terms of Christ enfleshed, Christ as incarnate. And that Christ as incarnate, yes, he would make a distinction. Obviously, that happened in history, but that's eternally what has been planned, the incarnation of the Son. So he's very hesitant to talk about the son without enfleshed. This is Logos Asarkos. He didn't want to, he did talk about it, but he didn't want to push that so that in some sense, into the very life of God, you have the incarnation. And Barthes, I think, was unclear, but a person like, say, a Bruce McCormick, who was, follows, he at least says there's one major interpretation he gives of Karl Barth, now begins to say things that, such as, well, the suffering of the Son of God is brought into the very life of God. So he now speaks about divine suffering, he rejects impassibility. He'll speak about immutability, but that's only because God has always decreed that this is the case. So there's no change there, but there's change in that, even in that divine decree. The experiences of the human Son of God now comes into the very life of God. And then, of course, you saw this with, liberal theologians, Jurgen Moltmann, who then talked about the suffering of God. And then it starts moving very quickly when you do that into panentheism, where something creaturely is now brought into God's life so that there's not a clear creator-creature distinction. God in his triune being as fullness of life, he creates the world, relates to the world, but he in his relations and within himself, he is not changing. He's not getting better or worse. There is constancy, stability, and some of the other areas we've talked about. But these are difficult, difficult areas, and so you have to say what Scripture says, right? God is eternal. He has made a world. He relates to that world, but there is not change in him. But there's real relation to that world on certainly the creaturely side, tied to his divine plan. He knows what time it is in history. He acts in history. The Son of God takes on a humanity that's space and time. And all of that is juggled and held together. And usually, in my thinking, because I don't have, I'm a bit hesitant to go too far in this area because I think you get into problems. It's when you start pushing and saying, oh, that must mean this. And then you say, that's probably not where you want to go, or that must mean this. And so often we're having just to stick with how Scripture describes these things, draw the parameters, make sure we don't transgress the boundaries type of thing, and then say, that's about as best we can do.
Yeah, when you step beyond the biblical text, it's always uncertain. You and I have remarked several times during these discussions on the doctrine of God offline after the recording that we just keep getting reminded at each step that that God is not us.
Yeah.
Uh,
Oh,
this
man.
is this is something very different. It's where we worship. We come to see that He is God. Let's
Well,
talk.
and the greatest, I mean, you think of at the human level where, people will, idolatize, I mean, make idols, icons of their sports teams, and they're so excited for this and that. And when you think of, why that's so idolatrous, because, I mean, God is worthy of all of our contemplation, all of our love, all our affection. He is the highest end, and to put anything creatureally there is such, I mean, it's sin, it's blasphemy, but it's also so impoverished, right? I mean,
That's right.
creatures.
That's
Romans
right.
1, we worship created things, not the creator.
Let's talk about God's immensity, omnipresence. First of all, define and distinguish those terms, and then expand on them with regard to space and matter with respect to his entire being. God with his entire being is everywhere.
So eternality and then immensity, omnipresence sort of go together, but they're different aspects. So eternality is speaking of God's relation to time, right? And so he has always existed, makes a world, and he's eternal in relation to that space-time world. Immensity and omnipresence particularly is speaking of his relationship to created things in terms of space, right? So he is fully present. Immensity is a term that has been used in the past. It's very close to omnipresence, but it's referring to, well, what's God in terms of space before there's a space-time universe, right? So that when we omnipresence is usually always directed to, well, God's made a world, so how does he relate to that world in terms of space? Immensity is just picking up the idea that before there's ever space and time, before there's ever a creation, God is without measure, right? God is fullness of his own life, right? He is eternal. He's immense. So it's terms that refer, immensity refers to God's being as God without a world, right? Omnipresence then is then tied to his creation of a world. So how is he in the world, relate to the world? And omnipresence is picking up the truth that God in his entire being, right, is simultaneously everywhere, right? So he's not diffused in terms of space. He's not in one place and not in another, right? So you and I'm in Louisville, you're in Pennsylvania. We're located in space, right? But God in his entirety of his being is simultaneously everywhere, right? It's enough
Yeah,
to
it doesn't mean that he's big and part of him is here and part of him is everywhere. That's the mystery of this.
Well, and of course, that's why eternality. So he is always existing. He makes the world, and he's always now in the fullness of his being, not only existing, but he's now relating to that world, but he's not limited by that world, right? So he's not limited by time. He's not limited by space. So that whether we are in, Australia, whether the United States, whether we're in China, we have the fullness of God's being with us, right? So it's there's no s parts to him. There's no
Right.
spatial separation of him, right? All that he is simultaneously everywhere. And then, of course, we then have to account for the fact that scripture will speak of God in his operations. He'll speak of him even in his presence differently, depending upon the various things in the world, right? So he with his people is present in a different way than he is with the unbeliever, right? He is present, God's the God of the heavens. That doesn't mean he's not present on earth, yet it speaks of his presence uniquely as the sovereign Lord and so on. He is present in grace with us, judgment with unbeliever, and of course you have a notion of common grace. But think of Noah in the ark, right? In the ark, God is present with Noah and his family in grace and in protection and salvation. Outside of the ark, the presence of God is experienced now as judgment. So they are now being swallowed up in the flood, right? So these different ways. So we have to keep this in mind where, say, think of the tabernacle temple. God dwells in the Holy of Holies, but you don't convey that. And Solomon will tell you at the dedication of the temple, don't think that God is located here,
Exactly,
right?
exactly.
But his presence, we often speak of it as manifested. Frame talks about covenantal presence. I mean, I think that's helpful. He's getting at the same idea. If you don't think that the presence of God in the Holy of Holies is different, then just try going in there and you'll find out.
Right.
And then of course we have uniquely all of that imagery of God is present often through created means, theophanies. But of course, in the incarnation, the Son of God, the divine Son, becomes present not just in a Christophany, but by a permanent taking to himself a human nature. And in that human nature, the Son of God is present, right? We can talk to the Son of God directly, right? Even though we could talk to him, in terms of his omnipresence, but we wouldn't see him through that humanity, right? We don't see the divine nature. So all of these themes are so crucial, but omnipresence is a glorious truth that God in his entirety is with us, and he's not off somewhere. He's not absent. He's not up in the sky versus with us. He is simultaneously present everywhere.
One of the Puritans, I forget who, maybe Watson, but anyway, one of the Puritans makes the remark that God's circumference is nowhere, his center is everywhere, which is an interesting way to put it.
Yeah, and of course, I think I first came across that, and this is not, the first guy to do this, but Paul Helm was always helpful in his reflection on. He has a book on the eternal God, and but the whole relation of space and time go together, don't they? So how we conceive of the space-time world and then God in relation to that space-time world, you know, those things are parallel, right? So that's why eternality and also omnipresence now are different aspects of God's relationship to time and God's relationship to space, and all of that has to be kept together. So the same God who is present with us is not limited by any of that space. Well, the same kind of thing is also then, that's how we sort of get our mind around eternality as well.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned, as one example, his presence in the Old Testament tabernacle or in the temple. And I think that's one question that often comes up. Another one is his indwelling of believers. God's presence is everywhere, but there's a special manifestation of his presence, a particular kind of relationship and ministry to them.
Yeah, I mean, you have to have that, and but I think with the indwelling, we'll have to be careful. I mean, I think a lot of people sort of, if they're not careful, almost what we would say univocalize, or you know,
Yes,
don't treat this
right.
as analogical language. So it's almost as if, well, the spirit is living in me, indwelling me, as if he's sort of located in me.
Yeah, right. Right.
Well, we have to be careful. That's why that's why I'm convinced. I mean, you know, God has spent many years revealing himself through the covenantal structures and through the old covenant and tabernacle and temple. What's he doing there? Well, he's preparing us ultimately for the coming of Christ, but he's also, we're sort of getting some sense of what does it mean for God to be omnipresent and dwell with us, right? He's dwelling in the land differently than he is outside the land. He's dwelling in
Very
the
good.
Holy of Holies. And I think with the Spirit's indwelling of us, right, there's a unique covenantal presence, right? He is present. He is in us, but he's not limited. He is omnipresent. The Holy Spirit is omnipresent. The Father, Son, and Spirit are omnipresent.
Right.
Yet there is a presence, an indwelling, and it's an indwelling that is uniquely for us by the Spirit that I think probably is even greater than Old Testament saints
Yeah, that's right.
experience. They experienced often the presence of God usually through those externals, right, in the land, through the tabernacle, through the temple, and mediated through the priests. But we have direct access. You know, think
Yeah.
of the access language that we have through Christ, so that we now are present, right? We have access to the Father through the Son by the Spirit. That's a presence that is real, and that's tied to indwelling and the work of the Spirit is. But we don't want to think that it's a kind of spatial location.
Yeah, that's right. He's not limited by it. And I think it's helpful to recognize that, all right, on the one hand, we have to affirm that God is everywhere in his entire being, but that does not preclude the idea that he can give us particular manifestation of his presence in various ways, in various places. We've experienced that personally. We've experienced it corporately as well in corporate meetings of the church.
Well, it's very important to pick it up in terms of corporate, isn't it? Because there's a promise that the Lord gives us that as we gather, that gathering is a greater, in some sense, a greater manifestation of the presence of God than we just have individually. Now, obviously, God is present with us as his people, right? You use that phrase Coram Deo is so wonderful before ultimately the presence of God. But you don't want to think, oh, well, I'm indwelt by the Spirit and I know Christ and I can stay at home and I can worship, you know, in nature and I'll have the presence of God the same way. No, there's unique means of grace and also the gathering of the corporate body. And we all, I mean, hopefully we've experienced this. I know you have, and I certainly have, is that we can weekly through the week fellowship with the Lord and be present and experience his presence in our life. But there's something about the church gathered, the word preached, that is different, right? And God's presence is in some sense manifested in that way, in a greater way, and that's why we're not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. We meet with God, and there's a meeting. Now, it's not that the church is the temple type of thing. We are the temple, but he comes to meet with us in a greater way. And if that's not experienced in our local assemblies, that's a problem.
Yeah, that's right. Marvelous truths. We will pick them up next week. Next time we'll start with the doctrine of God's omnipotence. Steve, great to have you with us. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks. Yeah, no problem. Thank you.